Hey, what's up, everybody? This is Alex in partnership with CoverPrice.com, the ultimate comic book resource, highlighting a book from CoverPrice's weekly top 10 report for the week ending June 8th. These are the comics collectors chased the hardest last week, driving demand and pushing prices across the aftermarket. Hey, did you see that footage of Nicholas Holt walking around the set of the Superman sequel Man of Tomorrow in Lex Luthor's iconic war suit? So did a lot of other folks, and the first appearance of that suit in 1983's Action Comics 544 jumped in price to $34. For a near mint copy. That issue also features the debut of a metallic Brainiac, so if that version is in the movie, you might want to pick up a copy now rather than later. The cover also features Superman faded in the yellow background, looking shocked, but if Superman is shocked in the movie, that probably won't impact the price, I'm just saying. That was a highlight from CoverPrice's weekly top 10 report. Want to learn what your collection is worth right now? CoverPrice.com does all the hard work for you. Tracking aftermarket sales for both Raw and Slab comics, CoverPrice.com lets you know what your comics are actually selling for. Interested in weekly new releases, FOCs, trending cover lists, and a ton of other great content? CoverPrice has you covered. Visit CoverPrice.com/comicbookclub today to get 1 month of CoverPrice for just $1. That's CoverPrice.com/comicbookclub. What's up, everybody? Welcome to The Stack. I'm Alex.
I'm Justin.
I'm Pete.
And on The Stack, we talk about a bunch of books that have come out this
week.
Comic books, in fact, to clarify, we're not talking about novels or anything.
No, Bibles or any of your holy books.
Yeah, you guys
find
any
fun comic was the
Bibles in your motel rooms this week?
My stack always begins and ends with a full reading of the Bible.
Yeah.
Wow.
It begins with John and it ends with Paul. Are those books of the Bible?
Let me be honest, I don't know. I have no idea.
Well, my Bible begins and ends with Absolute Catwoman,
yeah.
Number one from DC Comics, written by Scott Snyder and Che Grayson, by Bengal, who is a tiger and technically should not be allowed to draw.
But hey, come on. If tigers want to draw, let them draw, Alex.
There's no rule that a tiger can't draw a comic book, I say. This is a spinoff very specifically of Absolute Batman. We saw Selina Kyle in her youth hanging out with Bruce Wayne. She went away somewhere, came back as Catwoman. Here we're getting a little bit of a glimpse of that into her past and how that came to be, as well as her tangling with some imposters. A big reveal at the end that weirdly was spoiled by DC earlier today via a press release. But got this big kickoff to a big blockbuster title. What do you guys think? Is this a worthy addition to the Absolute Universe?
That's exactly what I was going to say. I didn't want to spoil anything, but this holds up just as good as all the other Absolute books, continues in a great tradition of Absolute banger comics. This Absolute Catwoman comic is glorious. The art is absolutely spectacular. Really impressive take on Catwoman. Such a cool story. Action is turned up to 11. I loved all of this. I loved every panel, every inch of it. This was just really, really impressive comics.
This is a little bit of a side note, but Pete, have you ordered Absolute Bangers on your motel room pay-per-view yet? Because, oh boy.
Oh, yeah? Something. It costs extra?
It's something. Yeah, it costs extra, but it's worth it.
Sorry, Alex is excited because we're all staying in adjoining hotel rooms.
Put a quarter in that bed and go to town.
Oh, yeah, sorry, I should say it's the worst hotel called a motel. It's only pornography and shaky bed, as Alex said.
The vending machine only has Payday and Gatorade. I don't know what's going on.
Yeah, that's all you need.
That sounds actually pretty awesome.
You need,
exactly. What are you hoping for out of a vending machine?
Yeah. Literally
Gatorade.
Anything else.
That's a really nice vending machine.
Payday? That's great. Yeah, I also really love
the
twist.
Put the Payday in the Gatorade.
The twists and turns in this comic are really fun and interesting. So I think they're really killing it. DC's doing a hell of a job on this Absolute line.
Justin, over to you for the counterpoint.
No, I mean, I will say my take on this was this doesn't really feel like an Absolute book. Compared to the others,
I saw her in an Absolute book. So how does that make that have
interesting? Yeah. Interesting. I guess I didn't read the whole title. I'm just saying, like, it's not a knock against it. This just feels like a cool Elseworldsy type Catwoman story. I like the sort of bifurcated storytelling. We're getting some nice background. I like that it's pinned around Selina and Holly as the two main characters, and we see them in different eras. Like, all that is very cool, but it just does feel less like we're stepping gradually away from what Absolute means, and that's not necessarily a bad thing. It just means that, to me, this is becoming a sort of expansive part of the DC Comics line, and maybe it's wild to me, I guess I should say. They're basically running two universes next to each other, and they're expanding. Both of them are expanding.
That's how it works.
I will take it a little bit of a step further and say I was actually kind of disappointed that this wasn't a bigger swing. They play fast and loose. And by the way, I should mention spoilers for every single book that we're going to be talking about here in the stack. So if you don't want spoilers, turn away. But they play a little coy, a little cute with it, with starting with a very traditional Catwoman. But it turns out there is a group of copycats, which very
twist.
Cute, very cute, that are that Catwoman, our Catwoman, may have used to have been a part of.
Allegedly.
They're coming back for an unknown reason, leading to reveal of the antagonist at the end of the issue, the thing that was spoiled by DC earlier on Tuesday, which is weird. But yeah, this could be a Catwoman book. Like, this could be a mainline Catwoman book. This, to me, felt a little bit more like what Marvel did with the Ultimate books, where it was just mostly a couple of degrees off, with some exceptions. Where Absolute Batman, you have the biggest, beefiest Batman of all time. Absolute Green Arrow, they just introduced, is a serial killer with an MNA Dinah Lance coming after them. And all of these titles in this line, the thing that we've been really lauding it for, beyond the writing reinvention and the artistic clarity and beauty of everything that they're putting out in this line, is that these are takes that, like, get to the core of these heroes and characters while remixing absolutely everything else. This isn't really a remix. This is a Catwoman story, but she has a slightly more bulbous and shiny head.
How dare you boil it down like that? She also has a legion of Catwomen. I mean, come on, dude.
And a tail. Well, she's fighting them.
Short,
would
bro.
You be shocked? Like, you cannot see a storyline of the mainline Catwoman comics where there's a legion of Catwomen?
No way. It doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
No, I agree with you, Alex. And again, it's not to say this isn't cool, because, like, there's a great action sequence at the back end of this, which I thought was great. Her sort of prehensile tech tail is very cool. Here's the thing. Pete's preternaturally disposed to love cats, so he can't be mad at this book, and he never will be. And that's going to come up later on in this deck, because I think there's more cats to be had.
There is more cats. Get excited.
But I think, like you said, the other Absolute books boil down the characters, but even more so, remix them for a darker world where their heroism shines more brightly. Mm-hmm. And Catwoman, not a hero. So you could say, well, that wouldn't be the case here. But I would argue, then, what are you shifting and what are you heightening in the character? Because I don't quite know yet, and it could get there.
That's right. It can get there. So,
well, the other thing that was surprising about this to me is Che Grace had talked about it a little bit at New York Comic Con when they announced the book. And she had said that the big difference is Catwoman doesn't steal things. She steals information. And we don't see that this issue. That doesn't happen. Like, we see the aftermath of her getting riches. We see her being like, I don't want to steal those jewels. And then she starts fighting with the other Catwomen. But I don't know. I thought that was a really good, interesting idea. And we don't see that really play out here. So, yes, maybe in further issues, I guess we'll see. Let's talk about another biggie, Avengers Armageddon, number one from Marvel, written by Chip Zdarsky, art by Delio Diaz and Frank Alpizar. This is the kickoff to the big event that Zdarsky has been leading up to in issues of Captain America, Wolverine, Weapons of Armageddon. And also, this really is kicking very much directly picking off of One World Under Doom, the Red Hulk series, Dungeons of Doom, lots of other things going on here. And it's also all teeing up a new Avengers team that was already revealed by Marvel the other day, so we know what's going to happen at the end here. What'd you guys think about this? We've been, I think, a little iffy, hesitant about this event going into it. Are you sold on it after this first issue?
Well, I think it's important to point out this isn't Avengers reenacting the Armageddon movie, which I was really looking forward to.
You know, what are you talking about? Wolverine. There's a scene. Yeah, Wolverine takes animal crackers. Yeah, and gets that's them exactly. Up, Captain yeah. America.
That's the scene we want to see again.
Yeah.
When Ben Affleck and moves an animal cracker.
Ross is hitting golf balls at an oil tanker, you know, Greenpeace protesters, and he's like, you crazy kids, you know?
Yeah, here's the thing. You're making fun, but back when movies used to play on TV, whatever Armageddon was on TV, I'm like, well, I guess I have to watch this now.
Good movie. Doing,
I've watched Armageddon a lot as well. I mean, that's why I can quote it and make references. It's a fantastic movie, but that's not
before
what we're
you
getting
just, I feel like I haven't really fully explained the quote-unquote sex scene in the movie when Ben Affleck is moving animal crackers up and down Liv Tyler's body, describing right. them as if they're on safari. That's a sex scene in the movie.
Right, yeah.
Great movie.
And none of that happens here, except for the sex.
What did you, other than that, Pete, what did you think about this book?
I thought this was cool, like a great cover. You know, we got kind of an evil Ross versus the kind of Avengers here, which I think is a cool setup. Yeah, I think that it was good to see Wolverine here, especially when he was like, hey, I don't give a fuck. I was like, yeah, Wolverine, yeah. So, I don't know, interesting setup. I don't hate it right out of the box. So I'm excited to see what's going to happen moving forward. But I also really like the art.
I mean, this, we talked in the lead up to this, there was a lot of talk about how like, oh, this feels a little bit convoluted and a little bit just setting up, literally leading to one moment, which I think in the case of the important moments that were in the walk toward, what was it called? The Road to Armageddon. It was setting up the Colton Captain America to be this super-powered wild card who will be in here. And then really just, that's it, I guess. And Red Hulk being in charge of Latveria that he's renaming into.
Yeah, he's like,
yeah, this is like,
wants to take out Doom.
I want to be clear. I don't hate this. Like Pete said, the art is very nice throughout here, very clean by this team. I do think Chip Zdarsky, you could feel, and I don't say this dismissively, you could feel like the sweat and effort put into here to be like, okay, I'm going to take these disparate elements, make them work together and fit them together. But it's all of these story points happening here that we've seen a million times before. Like, this is basically One World Under Doom meets Civil War. That's pretty much the whole thing that seems to be going out at this point. Plus, they throw in this thing where Tony has built a machine, and they're like, what machine is that, Tony? And he's like, well, I built it to predict crimes. And they're like, whoa, 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 that's too much. He explains, no, it actually doesn't tell him the crimes until they're really bad. And then they follow it up with him being like, and I have predicted one crime, which is that it seems like General Ross is predicting crimes. And I'm like, what? What is going on here that you're both doing the same thing? Like,
and I was like, this is convoluted and samey in a weird way, like you're saying. Yeah. But I would like to give the benefit of the doubt that maybe that's the point, because I do think this book is crystallizing some of the like political ideas that I think Chip Zdarsky is going after here. And you hear the voice of Spider-Man here, who's like, this isn't really, I don't want to do this. I don't want to talk about this because it's like larger world building ideas of democracy. It feels like Chip Zdarsky is trying to do a delicate dance of folding some of the realities of our modern world into the Marvel Universe in a careful way.
Now, I just wanted to agree very quickly with that. I think this does a better job of that than the stuff that he's done previously on this subject. I still don't think it quite gets there, but it's definitely stronger and clearer than all the Captain America stuff he's been doing. I do have to quibble a little bit with the Spider-Man of it all, because at this point, I understand we're sort of like in stasis with all these characters, but having Spider-Man being an event, be like, oh boy, guys, I'm just a regular guy from Queens. I can't deal with this
this big stuff when you're like, you were just in space. You were in space and you fought a guy named Hellmouth or Hellgate or Hellgate. Whatever it was, who is like a multiversal conqueror. What are you talking about?
Let me just jump in and say I agree with some of what Justin is saying. This is doing a great job of like setting up some interesting ideas. It'll be interesting to like what they cash in on in the next issue. And Zubs, what do you think about this? Because they have set this up. Wolverine dates Ross's daughter, right? And then General Ross is like, I don't want to work on with you on any job on this planet. And Wolverine's like, you know, I mean, that would be kind of an interesting
that's
idea.
One of my favorite lines from the movie Armageddon is when Ben Affleck goes, That is a great line. David Coulton, I don't know about him either. Like,
Feels important.
It feels important. Yep. This whole thing is like, it's leading up to something. Like, the problem with hooking into any of these plot lines, like, oh boy, Red Hulk has taken over Latveria, is like, that's not what this is about. And all this thing where they're like, we came up with a prediction machine. It's like, that's also not what this is about. What this is about is David Coulton being a Captain America, getting an Iron Man arc reactor. Now he's also Superman with mysterious powers that nobody wants to mention out loud, even though we know they're probably the Century powers. Yeah. And it's all leading up to something where, like,
because of the origin box that, again, he took from the last event, which was from the Ultimate Universe, which is split over here and brought by Miles Morales through because he went in there to get his sister because his sister was there. And then she was taken and he found her somehow. And then he came back with the origin boxes. Didn't know what to do with them. Then the Spot stole them. And then they ended up in a weird place with Wolverine. And then Wolverine got it to Coulton because Coulton was dying. And then Coulton needed it. And now Coulton's super powerful.
Yeah. This is... Okay, I do want to say something about that in a second, but just to like finish up the thought about David Coulton, this just all feels like it's leading up to a point where it's like, oh boy, Red Hulk's the bad guy, right? You think Red Hulk's the bad guy, and then they're like, oh no, David Coulton had Century powers. That means he has the void. We didn't realize it, and he wrecks everything, right? And that's where the Armageddon comes from.
Very well could be that, but also it feels like David Coulton... he's positioned in this issue to be like, he's going to kill people. And they're like, hey, would you mind doing that for us? And he's like, yeah, I will. And I was like, interesting.
Yeah.
I think where the Armageddon comes from is there's a meteor heading towards Earth. And how are we going to stop
it? You made your feelings on this very clear, Pete. I don't know what I was going to say about David Coulton. I think that like, we don't need another dark Superman in the Marvel Universe. We already have several of those, and they never work. And you always have to be like, get out of here, Hyperion. Leave us alone, Sentry. Otherwise, it's just insane.
Yeah.
The other thing, something that I've been thinking about for a while, and I don't know if this is necessarily a bad thing or not, but like, I feel like we have been seeing over the past couple of years the Russellification of Marvel Comics, where, of course, it's an ongoing soap opera, but it's just this nonstop story, this nonstop, like, here we go, it's the biggest defense, who's in that corner? Oh, man, it's Red Hulk, and that's it. And, like, that's always been part of the sense of comics, and this isn't to slag off wrestling or anything, but, like... there's a more pure just focus on the fight and the matchups and that's it in wrestling than there has been in the best of comics. And I think we've lost that. Like a lot of the Marvel events in particular have whittled that other stuff away.
It's interesting because I feel like DC's been doing that, but I think you don't have the same quibble with DC. Have they been more successful at it?
No, DC more overtly was like, we are doing a fight called DCKO, period. Yeah. Like that, they're doing that, but like the rest of the stuff is focused. I'm not going to say exclusively across the board because it's not true exclusively across the board, but DC is doing that. They're focusing on character, they're focusing on plot, they're focusing on the art and trying to make that work and what they can say through art first, potentially. Where a lot of the Marvel stuff, the reason I think it is not working is it's focused on like, here we go, big fight incoming, period. And then. I don't know. I don't want to fault the writers too much, and I don't necessarily want to fault the editors. I'm sure everybody's trying to do a good job, but like, I think there's a focus on like, oh, wouldn't it be cool if all these guys fought? That would be so cool. Versus, well, what are we actually saying about this thing?
If I had to diagnose what you're saying, it feels like you said, Civil War earlier, where it's like, it's premise first, it's sort of macro first, so you're not in through a character per se. Like, we don't have a real strong character POV here besides Red Hulk, arguably, who's like, I'm going to shove democracy down everyone's throat. And I'm like, okay, hold on there. I don't think that I'm just not on, I don't even understand that ideology, really. That's like something in our real world, even the people that are saying that aren't actually doing that. You know what I mean? Like, right. No one's really saying those words anymore. So I don't know. It's a little complicated. I think the art's fantastic, and I do think this is getting to a clarity point that I think could be good. I have one other larger point to bring up. Reading this comic, there's so much, and the other comics in the stack, so many characters now are continuitizing their conversations. Well, they'll be talking, they'll be like, well, you know, actually, his powers are a little messed up because of what happened back in blank. And I'm like, I don't need them to say it. Like, they could just do it. I don't need them to be talking to me about the continuity. I feel like it reminded me of reading, like, Greek mythology. We don't see, like, Zeus be like, yeah, and, you know, the other day I was a swan and I, like, fucked a bunch of nymphs or whatever. Like, we could just get that the stories are all happening and take the points we need and move on without having everyone always saying all the time their news.
Yes, agreed. All right, Mask number one from Skybounded Image Comics, written by Dan Waters, art by Pi Parr. We actually talked to Dan Waters a couple of months back, I think, at this point about this book, so you can go and listen to that. But this is the biggest expansion of the Energon universe in a while, focusing a bunch of dudes who wear helmets and can drive vehicles.
Oh, man. That's pretty crazy. Dude, oh, man.
I'm just saying, like, we can't do that in the real world. You can't wear helmets and you can't drive vehicles.
All right. Am I the only one who loved and saw the cartoon and have the theme song?
No, you know,
how
you and Justin
dare
both
you.
We've had this.
Well, it's, you know, I hate when he gets all sportsy ball, you know, when it comes to something he doesn't like when he's geeking out about other things. You know what
sportsy
I mean?
Sportsy ball, excuse me?
He gets real kind of elitist about where his lines are.
I'm never elitist. I'm never elitist about anything.
I'm
about to drop a take about Beachcomber later on in this stack that you're going to fucking love.
Well, the nostalgia factor is too high for me to really kind of look at this with any kind of clear eyes, because the whole time I'm singing the theme song and having such a great time to see all these kind of characters back and see Mayhem, who's completely out of his gourd in this. But yeah, the whole time I'm singing the theme song, having a blast, this is just way too much fun for my childhood to kind of give any smart opinions about anything. I'm just having way too much fun with it.
Great.
the art is amazing.
Good art. I mean, we talked about this when we in our interview from back in the day, like Alex said, but like, this definitely goes full heavy mythology building into the Mask stuff. We get a little bit of Mask action. I thought we would get more of it in this issue, honestly, without having to set up as much Matt Tracker as we did here, but
yeah.
I do like it. I like how sci-fi and like adjacent body horror this story that's set up in this is. I like the Mask stuff. I also was surprised we didn't get a lot of, like, we didn't get more cars turning into boats and stuff.
We'll get there, dude. It's the first issue. You know what I mean? You can't blow it all in the
Mask
first issue.
Mask was built around the idea that little toys, because the figures were tiny, in cool rubber masks were in car vehicles that turned into other vehicles. A helicopter turned into a car.
Well, no,
a car,
like we
turned
saw
into
with
a
this
boat.
Car, where, you know, it kind of turns into a plane. Yeah, some cars turn into boats, submarines. You know, some of them just launch cannons and can turn into flying things. You know, it's fun 80s toy stuff.
Do you ever feel like franchises should just die?
Not if you're enjoying it, asshole. If it's something that you liked came out in a different form, I felt lit up by this. I thought this was a great, taking something
I
love.
I thought this was a very fun comic. I don't know anything about this, but Dan Reiters writes a very tense situation. There is a lot of mythology building in here. There's some creepy stuff that happens throughout.
Oh, man.
I do love the idea of a guy named Miles Mayhem. That's very fun. Mm-hmm. I do want to see how this is different from G.I. Joe, like, because my impression is this is halfway between G.I. Joe and Transformers, but in terms of it being an addition to the Energon universe line, I want to see a little more delineation there.
Alex, you're saying it's halfway between G.I. Joe and Transformers. Is that because it's cars that transform and humans that are, like, a little bit cool with different methods?
Yeah, and
methods?
Have very specific names about what they do. Yes, yeah. All of that.
Wait, you think Matt Tracker's going to be tracking?
Yeah,
we don't need to get into that. Stuff? That's for a different podcast.
Yeah. I'm not trying to talk about that.
If you want to find out more about tracking and trackers, please subscribe patreon.com/comicbookclub. You can get our Week in Geek podcast where we go very deep into different ways of tracking people.
Yeah. Yes, honestly, we take a mouthful about that show tracker. But let me say about this. This is a mobile armored strike command with a K. The title is giving you what you need. What I give it, this doesn't say Energon every other word, and that's fine by me.
Yeah, they'll eat some Energon eventually, I'm sure.
Of course, we're all going to have a nibble.
Barbara Gordon Breakout, number 2 from DC Comics, written by Mariko Tamaki, art by Amon K. Nahuelpen. Barbara Gordon has been sentenced to a maximum security facility in order to solve a murder mystery, but she has ended up in big trouble herself. And this issue goes crazy surreal. I was not expecting it to go in this direction with horror as Barbara Gordon is sucked deep into a drug-induced nightmare over the course of the issue. I thought this was very unexpected
and great.
Like, this is much less Prison Break so far than I expected it to be. Like, that was kind of the setup of the first issue, being like, I have a plan to get us out of here. And this issue, it's just goes way off the deep end.
Terrifying at points. Yeah. The art really is, I love how moody it is, the psychedelic color palette, and it's great. And Barbara Gordon in a completely other role that we haven't really seen her much in a long time, which I really like. How do we feel about Commissioner Gordon and now Beat Cop?
Yeah,
How old is he canonically?
You think he's too old to work the beat? Is that what you're trying to say?
It's mostly about the fact that, like, I don't know, we all go in rounds in our careers, right? But, like, it's the same way that I feel about Peter Parker, who was the CEO of a company, being like, oh, boy, can I take photos for you, Mr. Jameson? Like, what? That's not how that works. That doesn't happen that way. And it's the same thing with him being a beat cop, which is fun, but doesn't make a ton of sense.
Become a detective or something, dude.
Yeah, I appreciate the fact that he's not beneath it, and he's out there kicking butt, even though his knees bother him. First off, cool cover. I agree with the JT says the use of tones and color in this comic is absolutely fantastic. This is crazy and scary, and the twists and turns are insane. Did she die in the last panel? It seemed like maybe she died at the end. Looking forward to what's happening, but great action. And I thought this was a lot of fun.
In a quick Reddit search, it seems like Commissioner Gordon is in his mid-50s. And to be out there on the street getting beat up all randomly, guess he can be like reliably be like one of these Bat Family folks will come and save my ass. Yeah. But I don't know. Seems dicey guy.
Jay and Silent Bob, Jays of Future Past, number 1 from Marvel, written by Kevin Smith, art by Giuseppe Camuncoli. Per the title, you'd expect it to be that Jay and Silent Bob travel back from the future or something like that, but nope. In fact, Dr. Doom is trying to kill them, so they take a tour of the Marvel Universe, which they live in, apparently.
Sure, and we all do.
Yeah, you know how it goes.
Yeah. I mean, if you like Jay and Silent Bob, the movies, any of the stuff, then, you know, there's a lot of references to all those movies and all the other kind of things that come before it. So I think this is a fun kind of in-joke setup here. He's a great writer, and it's fun to see him kind of having some fun in the Marvel Universe here. I think Kevin Smith has a good sense of humor, the quips, the back and forths. Are enjoyable. You know, you can tell he's a comedy writer and, you know, he has a good sense of humor. So I thought this was a lot of fun and kind of turned up to 11 with all the cameos and stuff like that. So, yeah, I thought this was a fun blast.
Shouts to Silver Sable and Sim Carrey opening this comic. Yeah, I liked
I knew you'd like that.
the statue. How much do you think you have to pay to get an Alicia Masters statue in the Marvel Universe?
Oh, probably a lot.
Yeah.
Expensive for your local clerk?
Particularly for Dante, the shopkeeper, who has still not died in real life, I believe.
Not dead in real life, I believe. So, interestingly, yeah. Dead in this.
We talked about this with, there was, I think, like, Quick Stops or whatever it was called that they did.
Yes.
Where they did a whole tribute to him, and I was like, yeah. Did he die? Did he die in real life? But no, he died in one of the movies, I guess.
He in real life didn't die. Shannon Doherty died. And that was a big emotional piece for this.
But then they did a thing about Dante, the character, dying.
Yes.
In one of the comics that we read, and I just do not remember which one.
But I think that was not real. That was, I guess, I think this is a storyline picking up on that very particular piece of continuity. There's some good jokes in here. There are some where I'm like, are you just telling a Mallrats joke again?
Yeah.
And they are doing that. They do a lot of that. One of the things that caught me here, which has nothing to do with the book, so let me say I enjoy this. I think this is a good pickup. If you at all like the Kevin Smith askewiverse, I think this is a good buy. Really fun and deftly moves between the different areas of the Marvel Universe. My other point, though,
yes,
isn't it weird? How did you guys feel when Magneto comes to here and he's a villain?
I was fine with it. Bothered you? Yeah.
I think Magneto has been a hero longer than a villain at this point, or at least lately. He is now firmly an X-Men.
But he's been on both sides. So
he's been on both sides, but in our lives, our comic reading lives, he's been a hero, or at least in the middle, way longer than he's been a villain.
And that's right? What threw you out of the story? You were like,
I'm not saying that. I just thought it lodged in my brain. And I was like, isn't it interesting? He's so many characters move back and forth.
Oh, you're not talking about, not in this book. You're just talking about in general. That's interesting.
It struck me in this book that he's positioned as a villain. And I was like, right. Because I'm like, he's been a hero for longer than a villain, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like Magneto was right. There's a lot of like,
Emma Frost, too, though.
Yes.
Yeah. Lots of them. Venom.
Firmly hero.
Great.
Sabretooth. I mean, do we just listen?
But I would argue that Sabretooth goes back and forth still. Yes. Venom, to some degree, or symbiotes to loop them all together, go back and forth a bit.
Let me ask you a question. Would you want to see Magneto as a villain again?
I don't think so. The rare character. I don't know if he can go back.
That's a good point, Alex. I think that's what bothers him is because he, JT says, has moved on from Magneto being a villain. And he feels like this is a step back.
And not only me, I think the character has moved on. As we've gotten to know him, that we've developed so much more sympathy for his views. I think the world has changed in our lives to the point where it's like, hey, you know what? This guy who's like willing to fight and like be violent for his people, that's moved much more to the center of our culture and view as we become more violent in America. Like, I don't know. I was like, I don't think Magneto can be a villain anymore.
Yeah.
Wow.
Interesting.
Hot take.
M1 Monster Racing League #1 from Image Comics. Written by Lily and Robert Windham, art by Jay Lee and June Chung. This is the first interior ongoing art that Jay Lee has done in years. He's done a bunch of covers. He's done a miniseries, but he's on it for the long haul here. This is about a girl who moves to a new town and discovers the Monster Racing League of the title, an underground racing league that's, I guess, about to be attacked by monsters by the end of the issue. What'd you guys think about this? Pete, you're clapping.
Yeah, well, you know, you guys were busting on me on the live show about this, but I was kind of thrown by this, it starts off very simple. You know, like, okay, she, girl has moved her senior year, you know, nobody likes moving, and, you know, when you're in high school, it's a whole thing, you adjust to new people. So I was like, okay, great, yeah. And then it was like, and monsters. And I was like, where the fuck did that come from? So I'm interested to see how this all kind of twists together, because to me it was an interesting story about a girl being in a new town and, you know, finding a new friend, and then also being like, I'm a great racer. So I was like, okay, cool. But then the monsters is like, how does that work? So, yeah, I'll be interested to see how that all unfolds. But we got a legendary artist doing interiors, so it's very exciting.
I mean, I think this is a classic example of this is going to be read in the trade more so. Like, I feel like the monsters are introduced as a last page twist, essentially. They're not even really set up in any other way. It's all about, like, getting our main characters into racing, which is cool. And the Jay Lee art is fantastic. Yeah. But yes, I don't know anything about how monsters race. Are they made of wheels? Do they have engines? Like, what are we doing here?
Can they turn into boats? I guess we'll find out.
Yeah.
I agree with you. I would take it one step further and say this is a classic first issue of an Image comic where you know what the premise is literally from the title and the cover. And instead they're like, last page, ha ha, I gotcha. And you're like, no, yes. You didn't get me. This is called monster racing.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, ha ha, it's a monster racing. Oh, that's on the front. Okay. Well, good. Everyone's on board.
Get to that.
I'm wondering if it's like a Jabberjaw situation where the monsters are.
Stop
like...
right there. We all know. When you say Jabberjaw situation, say okay. No more. You don't need to explain. Okay.
All right.
You're referencing a character from 1960s Hanna-Barbera animation, and you said it's a Jabberjaw situation. Everyone knows what you mean, Pete. We don't need to go into it.
All right. It's like what he was saying earlier about Avengers Armageddon. You don't need to explain anything at
exactly.
any point.
Just say Animal Cracker Sex, Ben Affleck, Liv Tyler. I know the scene.
Yeah. Or is it like a where the monsters turn into the car? You know what I mean? And you know what a 60s reference that is, right? So.
Of course. You're talking about the car, the guy that gets wet and he turns into a car?
Yeah, exactly. Wow, that's actually what I was talking about. That's impressive.
What?
Wait, the guy who turns into the car. Like he becomes.
That is a
crazy. Gets wet and he turns into a car?
Yes.
I remember.
Have you never seen this,
part.
Alex? I feel like you've seen this.
It sounds vaguely familiar, but it's just like I don't understand why does he need to get wet to turn into a car?
Yeah, that seems like
because
a gizmo.
Because they wrote it in a
that's
fucking
a gizmo
instant.
Situation.
It's called Turbo Teen. And it's a kid.
Turbo
who,
Teen.
Who, like, and every episode was an extended body horror moment of him being like, and his hands turn into wheels and curl up, and his face stretches out and becomes the grill of the car.
Yeah.
And his eyes become like the windshield and then fade away. It's crazy. You should look this up, Alex. You're going to like this.
Alex, check it out, man.
You're going to hate this and like this. But truly, Pete, when you said Jabberjaw situation, were you getting to wet car guy?
That was the other cartoon I was thinking of. You want me to now explain the Jabberjaw situation? Because you told me not to.
This is I was like roasting a fever dream right now.
I was roasting you about you saying a Jabberjaw situation. And
where the monster talks and drives the car.
I see.
Yeah.
Because did Jabberjaw drive the submarine?
Yeah, he drove the car. And he also talked and he played in the band.
I just want to mention the layouts are really good in here as well. They're like really beautifully done throughout. Why don't we move on? And
Alex is so mad. We're just talking about this comic, Alex. This is the job.
I'm not mad. I just feel like I'm going insane right now. The Fury of Firestorm at number 3. Well, the guy gets wet and he turns into a car.
That's
real,
Alex. That's not us being weird. That's reality.
Well, but you're just mentioning it in the stream of consciousness, and I feel like I'm just falling further and further into madness, similar to the Fury of Firestorm number 3 from DC Comics, written by Jeff Lemire, art by Rafael De La Torre. We have a crazed Firestorm who has turned an entire town into various elements. Why is this happening? Well, we find out a big reason behind it in this issue as we go back and visit one of the other wielders of the Firestorm Matrix. I feel like there's been a lot of disagreement in our Patreon Discord about this title. Some people really like it. Some people really hate it. I will say I fall on the side of really liking it. And part of that is because I like Firestorm. So I think that probably helps quite a bit. What, Pete, I'm honestly curious, like, you don't like Firestorm, so you're not into this book? Is that what's going on?
Well, I don't like Firestorm as a character, but this book does, two people
you love fire and
becoming
storms.
One, and then they're always fighting, and then, you know, like, I don't know, man. I just, sometimes things miss me, and, you know, I don't know, maybe it's because I have problems. But I think that the art really is an interesting kind of like tone. The colors, the kind of darker tones in this sets this up as like, this isn't, you know, your mom's firestorm. This is kind of a darker take here, and the way it looks.
Hey, your mom's
hold on. Let me call my mom and find out what her firestorm is.
Okay.
My mom's listening. I'm sure she's shouting along with what her firestorm is.
Roddy Raven!
Great mom impression right there. But yeah, the art has like a watercolor type to it that really I'm a sucker for. But this is an interesting take. So even though I'm not a fan, I'm trusting Jeff Lemire. He's such a great storyteller. So I'm giving him the Benny of the Doubt here.
Benny of the Doubt. Really good. I mean, we were talking earlier about the Absolute Catwoman. This book feels like an absolute book. Mm-hmm. This book feels like it has taking the Firestorm mythology, putting it in a darker place, and with the intention of revealing something about maybe collaboration, how we work with other people, the way we treat other people in that space. And that's really cool. And I think the art is fantastic. I like the characters we have in the group here. And I just think I reread all three of these issues coming into this week, and they really work together as a group.
Yeah. One quibble, that I keep throwing out there is that it does very much feel like what they've been doing with Captain Atom nonstop in book after book. It's the same basic thing where he's like, I'm a god now and I can change anything into whatever I want. And it's driven me crazy. But there's enough of the Firestorm history in here that does feel different, and it's really dark, and the place it heads to at this end of this issue feels like it's about to get even darker.
Yes.
This is a big spoiler, but he's headed towards, oh my gosh, I'm forgetting what city he's headed towards at the end of the issue.
It's just outside of York, Pennsylvania.
Orlando.
Wherever it is, he's heading to a big city.
No, it's Pittsburgh.
It feels like they're going to do another Coast City. Like, I really feel like we haven't gotten one of those in comics for a while. Like, we got Coast City with Hal Jordan. We got them destroying Las Vegas and Invincible. We haven't gotten an event like that in a comic book in a while, and I feel like it's time, and I think it's going to happen here.
And you want it to be Pittsburgh.
Yeah.
I also just wanted something that Justin talked about. Shout out to the Steel Curtain. The art is such a cool, because they have the flashback stuff where it's this old timey feel to it.
Yep.
Yeah, and they do
sort
such a
Jabberjaw
great job.
Style.
They do such a great job of like, having two different tones, yet it still feels like the same comic, which I think is hard to do sometimes. So just the art department's doing a hell of a job of making it all feel like the same thing.
And the only thing I would say about this that's different from the Captain Atom thing is always about Captain Atom being an asshole. And like, God, this asshole has gotten to be more of an asshole. When this, I feel like they're making a larger point about the taking advantage of a young person and the way that we are letting the Matrix in this case, but sort of an AI analogy, to have too much power and it could be everyone paying the price for it. So I think that is different than Captain Atom.
Bishop, number one from Marvel, written by Saladin Ahmed, art by Mario Santoro. Bishop is back on the street, and he's put his guns aside to just blast with his good old fists.
Yeah, fist blasting.
And, of course, a threat from the future comes back to haunt him, but has an ally headed back as well. Ooh. I guess we'll find out next issue.
Yeah, well, this cover kind of spoils the last panel, which isn't as fun, but I like this. I feel like this does a great job as a first issue, setting things up. Interesting story, great action. Great to see Storm. I felt like this was a solid issue as far as setting up an idea, getting us excited for more. Yes, please, more. Thank you.
I feel like we haven't really ever hung out with the character of Bishop and just like gotten to know him. Like, he's been always like a little bit of a cipher representing a larger premise or some other idea. Or in the case of one of my favorite interpretations, the battle in Cable, where Bishop and Cable were fighting each other as they pushed further and further into the future. And that was the birth of hope and all of that stuff back in the X-Men continuity days. And that was great. So it's nice to see him repositioned as a hero here and getting into some of the issues that motivated him all the way back from his first appearance.
Yeah,
I agree. I like Storm visiting in here and them having just a real conversation about some stuff. So this is a good start. You never know what you're going to get with these standalone comics focusing on a character we don't get to know much. And this really worked, I thought.
Remember Hope?
Skate Ali, oh, very sad. Skate Ali, number one from Dark Horse Comics, written by Sam Humphries, created by Sam Humphries, Kelly Sue Dukotic, and Natasha Bustos, art by Natasha Bustos. This is about some sort of a monster racing league, if you will.
What?
No, I mean, wow, I mean,
come on.
In a way,
no.
Yes.
Yeah.
Takes place in a future LA where skateboarding is illegal and only skateboarders
legalize
will ride. We focus
it
on the Skate Ali of the title, who is skating by herself, but ends up with a crew that may have a little bit of magic to them by the end of the issue. What'd you guys think about this?
This was awesome. This was a blast. I loved it. It kind of has a feel like Paper Girls to it with the art style, is great. I just feel like this is such a cool idea, and we get this badass main character, and just a fun setup, interesting characters. I like this kind of like new Skull gang and how that's all going to kind of go. And I also like this idea of like kind of they're talking about when you're doing something, kind of getting into the zone of it. That's where the kind of like power is and makes you better. So interesting kind of cool idea off of heightening like, being kind of good at something and kind of into a zone. So, yeah, I love this idea. And again, the art is absolutely fantastic.
I mean, this comic does a good job of putting you into a world without ever being like, hey, here's how it works. There's very little exposition here. It's just like skating's very important, so important that it's illegal and magical. And then we just ride with that idea. I think the art is the real star here, though. I thought it was great. I'm curious. We don't get a ton of, like I was just saying, revelation about the story, but the art really is fun and has so much energy to it.
Plus, skateboarding is kind of magical.
Mm-hmm. Seems
Bleeding
dangerous
Hearts
to me.
Bleeding Hearts, number 5 from DC Vertigo, written by Des Camp, art by Stipan Morion. Last issue, we had a human, an older human, and a child human who had been befriended by the zombie who has a beating heart, who is part of this new zombie society. They got captured by the zombie's friend, and we're dealing with the fallout of that in this issue. I don't think we've necessarily been iffy about this book, but maybe a little hesitant at parts. How are you feeling 5 issues in?
I love it. I think this is, I'm in the camp, the Dennis Camp camp.
Oh, yeah.
We're camping. I'm camping. It's summertime.
Camp.
It's time
yeah,
to camp.
Exactly.
I think the Stipan Morion art is so good. Really makes for a completely unique feeling book. The I want to shout out the letterer as well. There's so much done here because a lot of the zombie characters are named a complicated string of words. So there's a lot of lettering work to make that make sense and to really help with a lot of the emotion in the story. I just think this is really cool.
Yeah, cool cover as well. Run, bro. Run for your life. Yeah, the art on this is the real hero. This is creepy as fuck art. Just some really impressive style. The eyeball work alone is worth it. Yeah, but we got kind of a interesting, stressful scenario. But, I'm scared, but into it.
Daredevil, number 3 from Marvel, written by Stephanie Phillips, art by Lee Garbett. In this issue, Daredevil is trying to figure out the new villain who is targeted, not him exactly, but Matt Murdock. And he's recruited Spider-Man to give him a lesson so that he can more hone and focus his powers. I will just say right off, it was very weird reading this 1-2 weeks, something like that, after we had an issue of Spider-Man where Spider-Man had Daredevil helping him hone his powers.
They're buds. Friends.
They live
buds
in New York. They both live in New York. Come on.
You bump into people in New York.
Yeah.
Right,
yeah.
Come on, Alex.
I'm sorry, guys.
Pete, who do you bump into on your country roads beside the groundhog that you're battling with, which I know is a real, very real thing? Pete's fighting a groundhog.
Yeah, it's mostly the Amish. I think this is a great cover. I have some questions. Was that Morbius on the last panel reveal?
No.
Okay.
That is the new. So the cover says "Beware the Omen," and they referred to this new character as the Omen. That character is the Omen.
Oh, okay. I didn't know if Morbius was the Omen or what, because it kind of looked like Morbius a little bit.
Real quick on the name,
messed up face.
The name Omen, because we have Spidey and Daredevil chatting, and they
that.
It was cute. They sort of land on the idea. Daredevil says, "Oh man," and Spidey says, "Exactly, Omen." So now you just got to figure out if he's a good omen. I was like, did he just do that? Did he just make up the name of a character who already knows his name is Omen?
Yep.
That's not what I wanted.
Yes, that was very weird. Totally agree on that. I don't know. There's something about this title that, like, it came out so strong, and I feel like it's not quite balancing the elements that it set up in the first issue in the way that I enjoyed there. It's leading more and more into Daredevil stuff, which is fine. I like Daredevil.
Yeah, it's a Daredevil book.
Good. That's the name.
But given that we're focused on Matt Murdock, I would love to see a little more focus on Matt Murdock, but I don't know.
Yeah, I'd like to see more Foggy, but, you know, we don't always get
Foggy's in Miami.
Of course.
Miami Foggy.
What do you think Foggy's doing in Miami, Pete? Is it just cocaine? Because there's something in this issue. He's like, Foggy's back from Miami. We don't see
him. Someone who famously filmed in Miami, Justin, you should know, he's going around to restaurants. I mean, the nightlife in Miami, it's worth it.
Oh, do you think he's, like, eating on Miami Beach at one of the hotels?
Yeah.
Yeah, he's on the Miami Beach.
Eat before you die.
Nice. Really nice. So Foggy's creating he's working on a travel show that he's the star of.
Yeah, exactly.
101 places to Foggy before you die? Is that what you're
saying? I used to love hanging out at Miami Beach.
Oh, yes. God, the nights the three of us spent down there, it was great. We stayed in that motel with the shaking bed that Alex really loves. He keeps booking.
Can't sleep without it. You can't sleep without it.
Yeah, exactly.
Pete, by the way, you still owe me for the pay-per-view there. That was, like, quite the bill.
Yeah, I'm sorry about that. I didn't realize you could get charged for the same movie if you wanted to watch scenes again and again.
Great call. That's fucked up.
This is a good scene.
I know I'm going to have to watch that again in 10 minutes, is what Pete said.
Transformers number 33 from Skybound and Image Comics, written by Robert Kirkman, art by Jason Howard. In this issue, Transformers are doing a lot of stuff as they go around in their cars, and sometimes they're not cars. One of the things that's happening is Optimus Prime is a smaller car now.
Yeah.
Justin, though, I'm going to turn to you first. I would love to know your thoughts on Beachcomber.
Beachcomber, one of my I didn't have a lot of Transformers as a kid. But I had Beachcomber, and he was a prized character in my action figure play. Yes. He's tiny, but robot. And I had a lot of the Secret Wars Marvel figures back in the day. Yeah. So they were rubber, and you could, like, take the arms off and mix and match with different characters. So often Spidey in the black pre-Venom costume would end up with an Iron Man leg because Beachcomber would, like, tear off the leg or something fucked up like that. So Beachcomber really, it was great to see him in this issue. It's one of the first times I really felt the nostalgia come for me.
Hey, join the tub, man. Get in that nostalgia bath. It's
so anyway, Pete and I are nude in a tub together. what we're calling a nostalgia bath.
Yeah.
Alex, you want in?
What? No, I'm good. I'm great. But thank you guys so much.
Clean you right off.
You look wonderful. Yeah,
rub-a-dub-dub. I just think that this is fun to kind of see.
Three podcasters in a tub.
To see Optimus.
Yeah, nothing better with audio equipment than getting in a big watery pot.
Yeah, don't drop the sound recorder in the hot tub.
I think it's fun to see Optimus struggling with his new body, how he can be a leader when he's less than. It's an interesting idea, and I think it's kind of cool to kind of play out and to play with. But, fantastic art. You know, Jason Howard does an amazing job, and Kirkies is writing the crap out of this fun last panel. I'm enjoying this.
Yeah, we're getting, I like Optimus Prime, sort of like, or just Optimus. Yeah, just trying to figure out his place in the world. Starscream really fucked up on the bottom of the ocean, as we all are. We do get a scene in this, a panel in this, where a couple Transformers are like, hey, we brought gifts. Guess what it is? It's Energon! And they're holding a giant cube. And it struck me as like,
eat are the best gifts.
Yeah. But do you ever bring like a whole ham to a group? And you're like, I brought the ham. I feel like from now on I'm going to replace the word Energon with the word ham and see if it reads any different in this book when everyone's like, I have to get my hands on that precious ham. Oh, I brought ham. Where did the ham go? You have no
idea the power of this ham.
I can't bring my friends back to life until I get that ham.
I'm running low on energy. I need some ham.
Exactly. So I'm just saying, I think it works. A better way to read these.
It works. Justice League Dream Girls, a DC Pride event, number 2 from DC Comics, written by Nicole Maines and Jadzia Axelrod, Steve Underwood and Morgan Hampton, art by Brenton Stein, Dan Jurgens and Norm Rapman, Vincent Cecil, Steven Sadowski, Joe Quinones, and Aletha Martinez. The front story has Dreamer and Galaxy going through a dream state manipulated by the Key, who is trying to find access to some archives that only Dreamer can get him. And Galaxy is realizing she's in a dream state and trying to break Dreamer out. And then we get a backup story of the Green Lantern Corps.
Whoa.
I love this event.
Yes.
I think this is excellent so far. I was a little hesitant about DC splitting this into 4 weeks versus the usually excellent Pride anthology, the one big Pride anthology they do. But this title is so good. It, not to like knock something down to build this up necessarily, but I was talking a little bit about my hesitance or questioning about Marvel's Pride special, where it was the LGBTQ plus characters, but just kind of like fighting Ultron, period. And that's it.
Right.
What this book does so expertly is it doesn't forget that it's a Pride event. It delves into what it means to be trans. Particularly, there's like a barn burner of a speech from Dreamer.
Yeah, I love
this
it.
Issue here. It's oh my so God.
Good. So good.
But in the middle of, like, a lot of ridiculously fun stuff, big action happening, big plot moves for the overall DC universe as well, this is great.
Well, yeah. And I agree with you. I really enjoy this, and I think this is working so well as just a great story as well as a DC Pride event, like the title says. Because the scenes that we're falling through where Dreamer and Galaxy are like going through different DC character iterations while talking about like identity and all of that, I just thought it was just so smartly done and just beautifully. Mm-hmm. It works so beautifully to echo their very real conversation with these comic book themes in this comic book that also has a lot of just like straight up sci-fi and like superhero stuff going on all the time. It's amazing to me that Dreamer has become such a central DC character, especially around their events where like what's happening with her is big. It's always big. And we deal with a lot of the stuff in the past of this and still have an eye toward the future. Like, I don't know. This book feels so important all the time. And so like I love the focus on Dreamer throughout the DCU.
Yeah, I agree. This is really awesome. Really impressive art, a great kind of use of characters. Great to see Midnighter. The Dreamer and Galaxy stuff is just absolutely fantastic. Green Lantern stuff, just this is a tight package. It's really well put together. And sometimes, you know, I know when I'm buying comics, there's like special event stuff, but you don't, you're like, oh, should I spend the money on it? Is this going to be worth it? I think it really is worth it. They do such a great job of giving you, you know, not only great stories, but really interesting stuff that makes it worth it.
The Mortal Thor, number 11 from Marvel, written by Al Ewing, art by Jesus Saiz. This issue, Sigurd Jarlsson comes face to face with the Minotaur.
Minotaur!
Only his tiny little hammer on a string to try and stop him. I thought this was another really good issue of this, because one of my big questions about this title, we all kind of know that Sigur Jarlsson, yes, is almost definitely Thor, but he is just a construction worker with a hammer, a regular hammer on a string. So how is he going to fight all of these guys? That's what this issue deals with in very expert manner. And I like that. It's smartly constructed by Ewing.
I agree. I think that, first off, cool cover. And it's kind of a funny thing where the Minotaur is trying to do this villain monologue and the not Thor is throwing a regular hammer and hitting him in the face. He's like, knock it off. It's a funny kind of thing. But yeah, it does. I think it really works well in the story, and it kind of heightens this idea of like, it's not him and can he still do the things and that kind of stuff. So cool.
One big compliment I want to give this book is it's really got me to buy in on the idea that it's cool to have a rope with a hammer on the end. And
yeah, in the beginning you were joking about it, but now you're all in.
No, no, I'm still joking about it because it is weird. It doesn't quite make sense that he's able to do. He throws the hammer on a string.
You walk by construction sites all the time in New York City. You don't see hammers on strings? Come on, man.
Why would a regular construction worker be doing that? Like, he's trying to hit a nail from, like, way across?
You've never gotten cat hammered?
Yeah. Yeah, where it's like, you hear you someone from behind you, and it's a hammer hitting you right in the ass.
Yeah. Hurts.
It really hurts. But, I like the commitment to the bit, and it does work. In this issue, I buy how badass our human Thor is, and the way that what he does with Dario Agger, a character that is so hateable, is awesome. I love Odin watching and all of this stuff. Like, this is really building into something, and it's ridiculous, but I like that, too.
So you like Odin watch?
Yeah, I like Odin watching.
Yeah. I'd love for Odin to watch, you know what I mean? Fall of House of Slaughter, number 2 from Boom Studios, written by Tate Bromble, art by Adriano Tertolucci. Per the title, the Grand Dragon of the House of Slaughter is dying, and so everybody's vying for his spot. Mm-hmm. However, he only has one choice for that spot that he's trying to intimate very strongly to one of the other members of the House of Slaughter, and that is Erica Slaughter should be taking his place. He lays out the reason why. At the same time, there is a monster on the loose who is threatening to break open the entire secret about monsters in society. Justin, I'm curious to hear from you. You've been little iffy sometimes about the Slaughterverse. I think you like the first issue of this. How'd you feel about issue 2?
Yeah, I think it's pretty good. I mean, it's these books always spend just a lot of time on their stuff, and like I don't want to only criticize the pace, but it feels like the pace is just not always building tension in the way I want it to be built. This does feel like things are going poorly, but then they keep fixing it. Like I want to, like the arcs of the narrative feel like they're not as clean as I want them to be, I guess. And that feels across the board with a lot of these books. But I mean, I like this world. I like the Erica Slaughter of this. I'm curious if we are going to, we talked about this in the first issue, I think, are we going to get more of a continuity, a crossover between these titles or not?
Yes, we're building towards it, I believe. I think this is awesome. First off, cool cover. Also, cool Pride logo that Boom is doing there. This story continues to be incredible. The art is unbelievable. I love these characters. I'm really pulling for Erica to kind of become, step up into this new position. I just think this is really cool, and I love the confidence. This book is just kind of taking its time, telling its story, kind of sitting in these characters that are so unique and cool. And I also thought it was interesting when they had the kind of like story cover-up thing kind of happen. I think that's very timely.
Yeah, I actually really like this. I got to disagree, Justin. I like this issue quite a bit.
Yes, suck it, Justin.
Well, that's not what I'm saying. We're all allowed to have different opinions.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah, suck it, Pete.
uh, I thought this was very tense, moved very well through the different situations. I'm not the biggest fan of, like, House of Slaughter business meeting that we get in a lot of these spinoffs particularly. But here it feels like that is very much moving to the side as the other stuff becomes more and more important and the pot bubbles over. So that is good. I think this is a good place for this to be. It explains why Erica is important, something that I was wondering about after the first issue, so I dug it. Wolverine, number 21 from Marvel, written by Saladin Ahmed, art by Julius Oda. After a really tough couple of weeks, Wolverine and Nightcrawler go on vacation. Unfortunately,
the Absorbing Man
is there, and they get into a big fight. Leading to a big revelation about Wolverine. Now, I gotta say, we haven't been reading Wolverine a whole lot, but mm-hmm. they did tease, Marvel teased, that this issue and the next issue are a big event called Snapped, where Wolverine's claws get snapped in half.
What?
And at the beginning of this issue, that already had happened, and he's already in that status quo, so
lest we forget what happened with the adamantine.
Oh, yes. Right. How could we possibly forget what happened with the adamantine?
Yeah.
I got to say, versus what you said about Avengers Armageddon, it was weird reading this book after that, where it was like, well, but Wolverine's fine over there.
Yeah. Well, I mean, yes. But this is the book where there's another title where there's a lot of them saying their continuity. I was like, not necessary. Just hang out. And, like, honestly, the less you say about it, the better, because we don't want this to relate to the rest of the continuity, because Wolverine is fine in every other book. Mm-hmm. And I will say, I like a depowered Wolverine. I like him a little bit off. It's better. When he's too juiced up, it makes it seem it feels like this gives a little bit more storytelling opportunities. It's nice to have this every once in a while. Pete, I got to say, how'd you feel about, there's a lot of food porn in this, which is like Pete's second favorite porn. Yeah. So like you should weigh in on what you think about his rice burger egg gravy, the Hawaiian garbage plate that he has here.
Yeah, it's delicious. It's absolutely fantastic. They know how to do it in Hawaii. Yeah, I mean, this is kind of a funny kind of premise where heroes try to go on vacation, and the twist is there's also villains on vacation, because maybe villains deserve vacation too, but oh man, the fights do ensue. So yeah, it's kind of a weird twist at the end for Wolverine to be like, oh man, I was fine, but now I'm not, so I'm in trouble. Also, the eye bulging was really intense in this comic.
From Wolverine.
This Wolverine look is a kind of a, yeah, it's kind of a weird, sickly kind of Wolverine. So
sorry, just catching up on taking my notes, Pete. You, if I can quote you real quick, you said villains deserve vacation too, but the fights they do ensue.
Yeah.
Just right, make sure I'm writing that down. That's really
it's just rhyme and stuff. You know what I mean?
I don't know. Like, do I need to drop a beat? Like, where are we in this beat? And speaking of that, Wolverine finishes his food porn section by saying, "I'm more of a Molson guy myself." Pete, is he talking to you?
Dude, Molson's great, man. Who doesn't love a good Molson?
Molson X, I mean, that's like the hardest beer you can drink.
There was a little asterisk there, and then the box at the bottom say, "See Pete's dream from the other night."
Yeah. Exactly. I am Wolverine. I get drunk, which is another big revelation here. Wolverine's like, holy shit, I'm wasted.
Well, those Molson XLs, you know what I mean? Those really do it.
Molson, don't even get me started.
Like, that stuff is truly deadly.
Yeah,
I feel like they could have done a lot more with this premise. I like the idea of they go on vacation and then villains are on vacation. My problem is that the fights they do ensue immediately versus, like, you could have had a whole montage of them running into each other leading up to the fight as they try to do vacation stuff.
Yeah, like trying to have a good time, but then you're waiting in the Sunday line, and then it's like, oh, come on.
Like a fight that's a slow build fight, I think. Pete's on talking about a cruise, I think.
Yes.
Yeah, all things you do on vacation.
Pete's talking about the beef Sunday on whack line that we were in on the Comic-Con on the cruise ship.
Spots was the old beef on whack line. Come on, man. They had a beef on whack station.
Was that the thing that I tried the last day and got food poisoning? Or did you try and get food poisoning?
Well, Pete ate it every day, and I think I did too. So it wasn't that bad.
Yeah, it wasn't that
bad. But it wasn't that good for our bodies. To start the day hungover after casually 15 vodka sodas or gin and tonic, and then getting like, I'll start the day with a beef sandwich.
Yeah, that's
the only topping, gravy.
On horseradish.
Nice House by the Sea, speaking of cruise ships, number 10 from DC Vertigo, written by James Todd IV, art by Alvaro Martinez Bueno. The Nice House by the Sea has invaded the Nice House by the Lake. And now they have to determine who's going to live and who's going to die. Some big stuff goes down this issue. Justin, you were hyping this up on the live show, so take it away.
I was hyping it up because I like the way that the story is really converging now. And this issue pushes it even further. We get some character deaths, and we get sort of the reveal that there are two rival houses by different water features. And it seems like only one type of person from each house will remain, lest they make their case to each other and the Max alien in charge right now. It's great. I feel like the art here has just really improved and just been fantastic for so long. I think this is excellent. The larger, complicated arc of it is really coming together.
Yeah, I just wanted to talk, because it's scary and it freaks me out. But, man, the color choices, the art setups, the splash pages where it's, like, kind of darker, but the birds are just kind of light is just such a cool look. It really freaks me out. The smudging of the evil face is just such a creepy, cool idea that makes it seem dreamlike. You know, I just was like, it's so smart, so specific. Gets such a cool, like, specific feeling out of the readers. The story freaks me out and it's way too scary for me. But, man, artistically, it is it's another level.
I really like this issue as well. There's some great mythology things that go down here that change how we feel about everything that's been going on. I don't know exactly how to phrase this, but definitely like most toxic take here is I was glad when they started killing off characters because there are too many of them.
Well, that's what I'm talking about.
They give you a character guide in the back.
I know there's a character guide in the back. And like I've read every issue of both of these books. You can't keep track of them. There are 20 plus characters in this book. And when they killed them off, I was like, yeah, please do it faster.
Well, you're saying it harshly, more harshly than I was. But like, yes, it's time to winnow down and get to the bigger ideas here.
Yeah. The Sentry, number 4 from Marvel, written by Paul Jenkins, art by Christian Rosado. This is the final issue of this mini-series as the Sentry deals with the death of his dog and some crystals that are taking over New York.
Oh, man. How are you guys dealing with that?
I really like Paul Jenkins' work on the Sentry. This issue, as a conclusionary statement, I was like, oh, did Paul Jenkins' dog die? And he, like, told the story. Because I thought the way it resolved, I thought it was going to be something a little different or bigger about something else. Because it was really like, oh, Reed Richards defers to the Sentry a lot in his thinking. And I was like, that's weird.
There's one exchange that they have that was so weird to me where Reed was like, oh boy, what are we going to do? And the Sentry's like, well, you got to reverse the polarity. Like, he doesn't say that, but that's basically it.
Yes.
And Reed is like, oh geez, I never thought of that. Thanks, Mr. Sentry.
But you know what? That reminded me of the earlier Paul Jenkins stuff where it was the Sentry remembering his past in this very glorified way. So I was like, is that what this was? Was this all a, like, Sentry POV thing where the void is on the other side? I don't know. It really called into question a lot of my, like, sort of just reality of this limited series.
I thought this was kind of touching and nice, sometimes you got to fly to space and have a nice cry, you know. I thought that was nice that Sentry was able to do that.
And your space is a Dunkin' Donuts parking lot?
Hey, don't give away all my secrets, man.
Just give me the address.
I'm not going to have any cry spots anymore if you take them all away. But yeah, I thought that this was kind of a touching
screaming re-entry while you pull in for another 50 pack of munchkins.
Oh man, there's so many better donut places than Dunkin'. But yeah, I thought that the kind of dealing with the dark side stuff was interesting and cool. But yeah, I thought this was a nice ending.
The void.
Yeah, you know, it's dark side, the void.
Masters of the Universe, The Wings of Fate, number one from Dark Horse Comics, written by Tim Sheridan, art by Will Sliney. This is set in the same continuity as the movie that only I have seen on this podcast thus far.
Humble brag.
That I paid to see a movie. Movies are expensive. I don't know if you guys are aware of that.
Yeah.
Mild spoiler here, I guess. Pete, you read the comic book. You don't need to take off your headphones.
Okay,
you know,
well, I thought you were spoiling the movie. I'm going to spoil something
about the movie, but it's the setup for the comic book. This shows what Orko was doing during the continuity of the movie. That's what this comic book is about. It was the plot of this book.
Very Orko heavy, which I was surprised about.
I thought this was great. Like, I will say,
really?
I was not the biggest fan of the movie. I had a lot of fun reading this.
Maybe, this was great.
Maybe I'm Orko pilled. I don't know what to tell you.
Oh, well, my let me God. Say, because I oppositely, he loves I felt, it. I felt like too much Orko. No, I was like, never get me to other.
Maybe that was my problem with the movie. I don't know if I told you guys, but when I was a kid, my local library would have a science fiction fantasy festival, and every year they'd have a costume contest. One year, I dressed up as Orko, and I got runner-up. And as runner-up, my prize was a Dark Crystal vinyl record of the soundtrack that I still have to this day.
I mean, that is awesome.
It was all awesome.
Who won the contest?
I honestly could not begin to.
Was it a better Orko?
Yes.
It was all Orcos.
All Orcos. Huge character at the time.
I thought this was fun. It's clearly the kind of He-Man from the movie. And, you know, so.
Clearly, you don't see him.
Well, I had to adjust a little bit to this. But, you know, I'm a huge fan of Evil Lyn, Trapjaw. So the nostalgia baffle on this was strong. So I was having a blast with it. Some great art.
I mean, I do like as an entryway into the Eternia universe, the mix of technology and swords and sandals style fighting is awesome. Like, we don't get that very much. And so, like, I like this world, but way too much Orko for this.
Wrong.
So much hard. Also, let me see this costume, Orko. Alex. Was it just like an Alvin and pictures? The Chipmunk style shirt that you
had? You just have a long shirt and painted a zero on it? Like, what did you do?
I don't know. I was very young at that point. I legitimately don't remember. I know I did wear like a black thing over my face. I painted my face black. Is that
oh
weird?
My God. I thought
that's
for
what
a second.
You've been wanting to say this for a while.
Oh my God.
Is that cool? Canceled. Is that a cool thing that I did?
Do you think canceled. That's why you got runner-up or why you got
yeah,
runner
now
up?
I don't want to say who won because it's way worse.
Did
no,
you do
I,
magic?
I definitely wore like a black sock thing.
Did you do magic as part of your Orko?
No, I didn't do magic, but now I am feeling like there was some sort of performance aspect to the costume contest. And yeah. I used to do an Orko voice. I don't know.
What I wouldn't give for a first-hand video of this
Time Machine?
I just want to see you do a little bit of magic back. And win second place in this contest.
What is does Orko have a catchphrase? I legitimately don't remember. Like,
I want to go back.
He says,
in time.
"I'm Orko, your least favorite."
Does he talk with an accent like that?
He's got a funky
Nathan,
accent.
Nathan, he talk like this.
I think that's it.
Well, anyway.
Oh, my God.
Bad Thoughts. Well, that's this podcast. Number one from Ignition Press, written by Andy Parks, art by Dave Wachter. This is about a military unit, or more specifically, one guy in a military unit who has the ability to sense people's thoughts and extend that a little further, potentially to sense their future or things around them as well. And he gets sucked into the middle of a very deadly situation. I will mention Andy Parks is the guy behind Extraction, which is a comic book that is continuing with Ignition as well. So this seems very clearly to be like an across-the-plate pitch for, yeah, this will be a Netflix movie eventually for sure. But that all said, I still thought this was a lot of fun, well done, a well-thought-out world, a good, interesting central character. This is cool. I'll read more.
I agree. I enjoyed this. It goes hard in a way that I liked and positions the main character as someone who's going to have to choose between doing the good thing when both the bad guys and the good guys are doing bad things, which I think is cool. I will say, how do you guys feel about the cold open where our main character beats the shit out of definitely Stephen Miller?
Did you guys clock this?
I didn't clock that.
Go back and look at the way this character's drawn.
He was kind of a Stephen Miller lookalike. Yeah,
his name is Stephen Adkins, and he works in government.
I thought it was a shot at Scott Adkins for a second.
No, it is definitely a Stephen Miller takedown is my take.
Yeah, I wasn't sure who the last panel reveal was, but I had a great time with this, so that the action was great. Fun premise, dude reads bad thoughts, beats the shit out of evil people. Fantastic. I wouldn't get tired of that.
Next up, Civil War Unmasked, number 2 from Marvel, written by Christos Gage, art by Edgar Salazar. This is continuing a series of snapshots, vignettes from back of the days of Civil War. Here we're focusing on the decision that Peter Parker made to reveal his identity to the entire world, the lead up to that, and the fallout afterwards. I feel like we were all pretty pleasantly surprised by the first issue here. How did we feel about issue number 2?
I just want to say shouts to this book, this issue, and this title. Like, this is just like a conversation book where characters we like are getting into the bigger details and implications of stories that we already know. And that's, for like real comic heads, that's awesome. I love the deep dive of this. I liked the way that we really got to see him explore this with Mary Jane. If you're a fan of a Peter MJ romance, there's definitely something for you
kissing
here.
In Central Park. Yeah.
Yes.
This beautiful was the serenade. Greatest. The next time I see Christos Gage, I'm going to shake his hand and say thank you for this comic. Just to see them smooching it up was just my heart was singing. I was so happy. This is what should be happening in superhero comics. I was just so happy that we got this moment. Such a beautiful moment in Central Park. What a lovely, lovely idea. And so
I'm sorry, when you say this is what should be happening in superhero comics, do you mean that Peter and MJ should be making out in every superhero comic?
Yep.
Oh, okay.
Wow.
Just wanted to check.
Even Godzilla?
Yeah, exactly.
Great.
Cool.
I agree. This is also, I also agree. This is very well done. Like I said, with the first issue, Christos Gage is kind of just a master of this sort of thing.
Hell of a writer.
And going into this, I was like, I've read or heard about this a lot already, but I feel like he found new nuance and new ways into it and didn't ignore a fun action sequence with Hydro Man at the end either. So really good series. Very surprising. Last but not least, Monsters in Love, a Pride anthology number 1 from Dark Horse Comics by Tate Bromble, Isaac Goodhart, Mikel Muerto, James Tynion IV, Noah Dow, Lee Ostertag, Kenny Roten, Jadzia Axelrod, Bailey Rosenlund, Vita Ayala, Claudia Aguirre, Josh Trulio, Ed Luce, Lila Sturges, Vash Taylor, Jacob E. Salcedo, Zoe Tunnel, Tench, and Sina Grace.
Woo!
Now, if you have read The Oddly Pedestrian Life of Christopher Kreos, you know that sometimes they have backups that are monsters in love. They're about exactly what it sounds like. Either two monsters in love or a human in love with a monster or something like that. Mm-hmm. And usually exploring different sexualities as well. Here we get a framing device of Christopher Kreos finding out about comic books from his friend and then a bunch of monsters in love stories throughout that I believe have not been printed before. I kind of expected this would just be a collection of those backup stories. It's not at all. It's an entirely new thing. And I thought it was delightful. Beautiful art, beautiful stories, very fun.
a true anthology where we're just seeing stories across that just great creators are interested in. It's got to be exciting to have this be just come into existence. I feel like Marvel and DC do their Pride anthologies, and we don't really see many more than that. It's really cool that this was made. So shouts to that. And I really liked the last three stories were my faves.
Oh, wow.
There's the
so you're talking about the Peacock and Fireboy and the Green Goblin and the Dragon, and then the Thruple with the zombie?
Thruple with zombie.
Zombie Thruple?
I liked Growing Apart, the one about the couple, which was a nice, like, sort of metaphorical zombie story about a relationship I thought was cool. The vampire where sorority fights back against the dude I thought was awesome.
Yeah.
The Thruple one was interesting, fun. But I feel like, Dragon Boy, but the next one, I think. Oh, the Cena Gray story I enjoyed as well. The Phoenix. Yeah.
I thought, first off, great cover. I thought this was such a fun collection of stories. The vampire and the demon love, and the first one, you can bite me as hard as you want. Ooh, saucy, love it. The ghost partner one was cool. The witch kiss was a great one.
I wanted to give Bigfoot. A shout out to the witch one, just because that was by Jadzia Axelrod, who also co-wrote Dream Girl, so a good... Right. 1-2 punch for her, because I thought that witch story was really sweet and funny. It's about a witch who changes from a male body to a female body and finally finds herself more herself, but it's more about what it does to her best friend than her. And I thought that was a really interesting perspective.
Yeah.
Yeah. Very cool. Yeah, and the great. Christopher Chaos wraparounds I thought were really nice.
So good.
Well. Yeah.
Yes. Great stuff. Definitely pick this up. And folks, that is it for the stack. If you'd like to support this podcast and all the podcasts we do, patreon.com/comicbookclub. Also, we do a live show every Tuesday night at 7 p.m. to YouTube. Come hang out. We'd love to chat with you about comics. Apple, Spotify, Android, or the app of your choice to subscribe, listen, and follow the show. Comicbookclublive.com for this podcast and many more. Until next time, we'll see you at the Comic Book Club. Bye.
Watch Armageddon, guys. It's all we talk about. If you haven't seen it, you're gonna really either like it or just not like it.
You gotta watch He-Man, you gotta watch Transformers, you know, all the good stuff.
Masters. Of the